Yo, what is up, True Crime Murderinos? Welcome back for part two of the disappearance and murder of journalist Kim Bob. If you're not caught up, I suggest going back an episode. In part one, we discuss, you know, the actual incident, the crime. I introduce our two main characters. We have Kim Bob, who is the victim here, and Peter Madsen, the perpetrator. We discussed the crime in its entirety and kind of got ourselves caught up to where we are now, which is going to be the trial. We'll look a little bit into the actual evidence that was coming up in court and what different people were bringing forward. Some of the evidence included discussions about his lifestyle choices and, you know, his interactions within the BDSM community. So we're going to talk about some of that as well. We will get into the psychology of the criminal here. If you listen to episode one, I'm sure you have so many different ideas about what could be wrong with this dude. I have never treated him before, but, you know, based on what I'm hearing and the crying and some of the footage I've seen, I will kind of discuss some of my own interpretation of what might be going on. Also, you know, how some of his childhood might have contributed to what happened here. So yeah, if you are caught up, sit back, relax, and let's finish up the disappearance and murder of journalist Kim Bao. So March 8th, 2018 is when the trial begins, okay? Prosecutors are finally bringing their case forward, and this is taking place at the Copenhagen City Court. Madsen is still here pleading not guilty, and you know, we're thinking that, let's see, is he ever going to plead guilty, or is this guy going to just continue lying like he's been doing? The case was all over. It was not just in Denmark and Sweden, but several different countries, several different languages. This was just a global situation here. And there's live bloggers. They're, you know, tweeting and blogging, you know, real time on what's going on here. Honestly, it was just very closely followed. Apparently, when Madsen enters the courtroom, you know, he's very engaged. He's making a lot of eye contact with people. He's very vocal. He was a witness for his own case, so he's answering questions, but, you know, very vocal. And a few people comment on the fact that the eye contact kind of felt a little bit like, you know, like as if he was trying to intimidate them. He was definitely walking in, not like someone who felt guilty or felt ashamed. So when the prosecution is asking him about, you know, a little bit about his story, you know, why does he keep changing these stories? You know, we've had three or four different stories for him right now. What's, you know, explain this. And Madsen, his exact words are, what I would tell you today is a grim story that I did not want to tell anyone ever. But then he just goes on and continues with his carbon monoxide tale and, you know, his excuse for changing these stories so many times are apparently he did not want to, you know, he was thinking of the family. He didn't want the family to imagine that there was this long, gruesome death. He wants them to think that, you know, it was very quick and he's protecting them. The thing is, that doesn't even make sense because if that is true, why would the carbon monoxide story not be the first? Because that's a pretty calm, relaxing passing away. You know, carbon monoxide, you're kind of supposed to just like pass out and fall asleep. I mean, the dismemberment that you committed after is not that very calm and peaceful. But, I mean, and in general, this is just complete BS at this point. He's just saying whatever he wants, okay? ¶¶ So some of the evidence that's brought up in court include a lot of it is coming from that text search. So what they're finding in his computer and on his phone. And I discussed some of this in part one. What the prosecutors bring forth in court is that at the time of death, around the time of death of Kimball, and you know, the days leading up to her passing, Peter Madsen had Googled beheading, girl, and agony from his phone. They also are trying to prove that this was not some freak accident that happened, or even, let's say, like a sexual assault that just got out of control. This was premeditated, and the murder was premeditated. And the way that they're trying to prove this is to show, you know, the internet searches, and then also he packed the submarine with pipes and straps, and these are the things that were used to weigh the body parts down. So he was thinking as far ahead as, you know, these body parts that I'm gonna have to be getting rid of, okay? They're also going to bring up that, you know, there's this orange saw that was packed in the submarine. And all his colleagues confirm that there's absolutely no reason that you would need a saw on a submarine. One thing that's really scary is that in some of his own footage that his crew had taken, you know, they were doing this documentary on his submarine on the days leading up to and the day of the incident, there's footage. And so the day of, literally 5 hours before he's meeting up with her, you can see right behind him and with his tools, there's this orange saw. And then in another shot, you see that it's gone. So it's like somewhere in between these two shots, this guy packed the saw in the submarine. And then colleagues can attest to the fact that, yeah, we saw him walking and it was under his arm. And then, you know, a couple of weeks later, we find it in the Sound with body parts and clothes and pipes. And so he's like packing up for his mission while he's on camera and, you know, clearly premeditated and clearly doesn't even care at all if this is caught on footage. The body parts from the autopsy, they show that flesh reacts a certain way when it's wounded, when you're alive versus when you pass away. And so not necessarily that it was healing, but, you know, you could just see that the way the body had reacted from these stab wounds and even some of the cuts, this is flesh that was live, you know, not flesh that was already dead. So this is one way also that they're showing that this person, you know, this was someone that was killed, okay? The Royal Danish Navy, they also confirmed that a sinking was not possible. There's nothing here in the submarine that's showing a malfunction. This was an intentional act. You know, the way that it started to sink, only one way could have been completed, and it means someone has to intentionally go and start filling this submarine up with water. And they also confirmed that there's no poisonous gas, no carbon monoxide detected in that submarine at all. Another thing that was brought up in court was some of his lifestyle practices. And so Peter Madsen was in an open marriage. And he went to a lot of play parties and he was into a lot of BDSM play and he had a lot of other partners. And so some of these partners, you know, shared some of, you know, their experiences with him and some of the text messages they had with him. And so, you know, kink and BDSM and play parties and open relationships, all of this is completely fine, especially, you know, it's consensual. And sometimes these relationships can have some of the most open communication. So this is not a comment on that community, a negative comment on that community at all. It's, you know, Madsen actually was seeking this lack of consent and kind of masking in this, you know, oh, I'm just in this BDSM community and that's what I'm doing. So yeah, he was just hiding within the community. That's not really who he was. Let me go back. First, let me not assume everyone knows what I'm talking about when I say BDSM. This stands for bondage, dominance, submission, or sadomasochism. And it was coined in 1969 by Paul Gabbard, who was part of the Kinsey Institute, coined in one of his essays, Fetishism and Sadomasochism. The Kinsey Institute is an organization focused on researching culture, sexuality, gender, reproduction, And, you know, just preserving this history so we can have something to look back on and to track and, you know, just to share our history. And so I've been around since 1947, and in 69, BDSM was coined. But, you know, we have seen historical references to this type of community, this type of BDSM play has been around, honestly, as early as ancient Greek times and in several different cultures around the globe. So, like I said, he's more just hiding in this community. And some evidence brought by partners included text messages. And there's one here where Madsen says, "I'm just a perverted poly with a dream of a taboo-free place where all adults in their right mind can do to each other whatever they want." So this just feels like, you know, like he's taking these concepts that we find in non-monogamous communities and, you know, healthy, sexually open communities, and then applying his twisted desires onto them in ways that, you know, seem to fit, or, you know, almost seem like, you know, his comment or action may be appropriate. And, you know, when you really think about it, it's not. And, you know, it's almost like he's saying, "Hey, I'm just being open and honest. Don't judge me." But really, it's just a manipulation of sorts, because you're part of this. Just because you're part of this open poly community does not now mean that it's appropriate to be open to non-consensual violence and, you know, being open to making others uncomfortable with these comments and then making others feel like they have to accept them or else they're not open themselves. You know, because, I mean, clearly he's not just a perverted poly. He's a sadistic rapist and murderer, right? So there's also other text messages that were brought forth. And this one is scary because, like, these were possible potential victims. And one of them, he had apparently texted them, "I'll tie you up and pierce you with the skewer." And then he says, "Then the hobby knife comes out and I look at your throat. Where is the artery?" So a couple of these people were traumatized because, you know, they were even invited onto the submarine, and they were like, "Oh, yeah, cool. I'm going to come on the submarine." And then they say last minute, like, "Oh, can my husband come or can my kids come?" And suddenly it's like, no one else can come. And so you can kind of assume what he was going to do there. You just happened to not be able to make it, or you were busy that day. And yeah, this was just really terrible. And then I think about it, like, if I was invited to go on a submarine with someone who was really famous and really well respected, I probably would have gone. I'm going to be honest. And I am a person who is so hypervigilant and, like, scared of almost everything. I mean, okay, so maybe I wouldn't have gone. I probably would have gone and brought, like, mace and, you know, my Swiss Army knife and my taser. And it probably would have been at the bottom of my purse after, like, 10 minutes of talking, because I would have gotten comfortable and I would have forgot and thought I was being silly. And also, what am I actually going to do with my freaking mace and my pink little, you know, Swiss Army knife? So this is just terrible. Okay, so April 25th, 2018, the verdict finally comes in, you know, after everyone looks at all this evidence that was brought up, all his history, his tech history, and what different people have come forward to say. And so this was a 7-week trial in total, and the verdict comes, and he's given life in prison. And the charges are premeditated murder, aggravated sexual assault, and desecrating a corpse. The judge, Judge Antar Burkle, makes a statement here. "This is a cynical and pre-planned sexual assault of a particularly brutal nature on a random woman who, in connection with her journalistic work, accepted an invitation for a sailing trip on the accused submarine." So this was Burko's explanation as to why they gave him a pretty severe sentence, because in Denmark, life sentence is not given often. And then especially when someone has killed one person, you know, usually it's like multiple people, or you have like a history, criminal activity. So, and they also kind of gave some special circumstances to the fact that Kibbal was a journalist, and this is something that she was doing for work. So they considered that when they sentenced him. The only thing that's a little bit scary here, and I don't know, I might be freaking out for no reason, But in Denmark, after 12 years, you can apply for a pardon. Even if you're given a life sentence, you can apply for a pardon. And 16 years is the average life sentence in Denmark. So it makes me wonder, but he clearly was very smart. But then this crime was just so stupid. You know, how did you not think you were going to get caught? So then part of me is like, oh man, is he actually considering the fact that like he's most likely that he might be out in 16 years? Was this what he was willing to pay to finally fulfill this fantasy of his? You know, if I do get a sentence, okay, average of 16 years, I don't know. But then also at the same time, this crime was so horrific that maybe this is going to be someone who's not getting out in 16. You know, they're going to keep this guy for like at least, you know, until his very, very old age, if not really just life, which is really honestly what he deserves. So that's a look a little bit at what happened, the court case, the verdict, and then let's get into a little bit of his psych next, which is kind of interesting. He does get a psych eval, and so we're going to immediately hear a little bit about what they had to say. And then just based on the crime and some of the footage I've seen on him, I'll kind of like go into what I think he might have done. I've never treated this guy before, so none of this is confirmed or can be, you know, diagnostic, but yeah, I'll just share what I think might have been going on here. Peter Madsen had a psych eval. A psych evaluation was completed when he was detained, and some of the results were brought forth in court. So, not surprisingly, what the psychiatrist had to say was that Madsen showed a severe lack of empathy, doesn't really have the ability to experience remorse or guilt. And I mean, just from the action alone, I think we really need a complete psych eval to figure that out. But you know, they probably asked a couple more questions just to see how he feels about other situations. And, you know, in scenarios where we would probably have more empathy or sympathy for others, he most likely just does not have the ability. So that's what we get from the psych eval that was brought forth. And you know, I was kind of interested in general in Madsen's psychiatric background. I couldn't find anything in specific. Like, I didn't find any diagnosis that he was carrying or any treatment that he had in the past. But I was still a little interested, you know, and in wanting to kind of do my own, I don't know, like amateur eval. I'm a psych nurse practitioner, and so I deal with clients who struggle with different mental health conditions and trauma backgrounds. And so I kind of was digging a little bit into Madsen's background, into his childhood, to see what could have been going on there and how that could have contributed. And then, you know, if there was already maybe some underlying mental health conditions there as well. So a lot of the footage that was available also shed some light into his behavior and his mood states. A lot of times, Okay, so narcissist was thrown out many times, which, you know, a lot of times people throw that out. And that was all over the place. Many people who met him and people who were just reviewing the case and seeing what was going on and his personality, they would just, you know, mention that he's a narcissist. So whether you mention it jokingly or this was like diagnostically, I do feel like he just portrayed a lot of those behaviors that we look for. So, you know, feeling superior when compared to others, feeling like he's smarter than everyone else, and, you know, just moving through the world where you feel like others are inferior. And so, you know, if you're feeling that way, this can possibly explain a little bit, you know, about why you're able to do something like what he did. If he's feeling like Kimval is inferior to him, you know, even as just another species on the planet, then yeah, this can possibly explain why it might have been easier for him to do something like this compared to one of us. Then, you know, if you consider that he has this lack of empathy, can't really experience remorse or guilt, boom, you can easily explain, that's even explaining more why he might be able to do something like what he did. This narcissistic personality trait of his is also probably why he couldn't work well with others. You know, he really can't handle rejection. He can't handle being told that he's not doing something right. It probably doesn't even register with him that others might have valid opinions and that he can learn from others. And so, you know, just like how I discussed in episode one, when he was working with suborbitals and then they were not really accepting all of his ideas and they just couldn't work together. There was clashing so much and he couldn't take any criticism. He couldn't be told that what he was doing was maybe not the best way or was not entirely right. And maybe, you know, he couldn't even accept the idea of getting advice from others. And this is just part of some of those narcissistic traits where that in reality were part of his downfall. And with this comes a lot of anxiety and anger and then just, you know, revulsion at the idea that you're possibly not doing something entirely right and you're not perfect. And then that just makes you more irritable and anxious, and angry. And honestly, I feel like narcissists are really some of the most insecure people ever because just imagine being so hyper-focused on what others are thinking of you all the time. Others have to know I'm smarter than you. I'm better than you. I know more. You know, I could never be wrong. And so it's just, I mean, it must be exhausting. You know, first of all, having to always be portraying that you are this superior being. And then constantly being faced with moments where, you know, you probably made a mistake or you were wrong. And then you have to now battle within yourself because you can't admit this to yourself or to anyone else, you know, but clearly you're messing up and people are rejecting you and kicking you off Suborbital's team. Now your Rocket Madsen team is dropping off and people are not staying committed. And you have to try and plan this murder now. And immediately you don't even have a story and you're just getting caught and everything's falling apart. So, I mean, yeah. Also, I feel like if he was going to meet criteria for a mood disorder, I saw some traits there that made me feel like maybe this was some severe untreated bipolar disorder. There were some times in the footage where it looked like he was in a manic state. He was just restless and irritable. And, you know, there was this impulsive, eccentric behavior. It was just so prominent. And, you know, I think that's what attracted a lot of people to him. He was just this creative with these wild, amazing ideas. And a lot of people who have these ideas, you know, someone just comes up with an idea and it's like, let's just do it. Yeah. Wow. And it just seems like nothing can stop you and there are no boundaries. You know, it's exciting. And so I think that's why a lot of people were drawn to him. But then unfortunately, there was no real organization. He had all these amazing goals, and when it came time to actually produce, the structure wasn't there. And so a lot of people on his team initially would be working with him and really motivated, and they would just love this fire and passion that he had. And then quickly, they would just, you know, leave the team because they're like, okay, I don't think it's actually happening here. He's always snapping at people. He gets in this rage, he gets irritated very easily, and, you know, he can't organize and put something together. You know, this project is just not actually happening. And unfortunately, this happens to a lot of people. Okay, let me say, being bipolar does not predispose you to violence or murder. But, you know, I'm just seeing, like, with some of his childhood background that I'll get into in a little bit, And then this lack of empathy, lack of remorse or guilt, then this narcissistic personality trait. It's kind of like this melting pot here to kind of put together like a horrible madman. So what's unfortunate, so what I was saying earlier is what's unfortunate is that sometimes people who are struggling with bipolar disorder and are in this manic state, life can be extremely difficult because there's all this despair and depression and this dissatisfaction in life because you can have all these amazing creative ideas, sometimes more than like your average person who is consistently in more of a, you know, stable euthymic state versus these manic states, right? So you have all these ideas, but then you just can't accomplish any of them because you don't have, part of being that manic state means it's a little difficult to organize and to plan and to think of the bigger picture. And, you know, the longevity of plans are a little more difficult because your ideas and goals are kind of moving with your mood states. You know, when you're manic, it's like, oh yeah, we can do it. And then boom, when that manic state is out, maybe you're not as passionate or involved in the project. So there's this dissatisfaction in life and depression that's related to that. And then there really is just now the chemical imbalance and you literally cycle between manic states and depressive states. And so, you know, you're kind of isolating yourself from others and you're just dark and all these like, you know, depression. If anyone's been depressed before, I mean, it's super, super common. I'm sure I've been depressed many times. And I mean, I know I have. So yeah, it's horrible. But now think of this constant cycling, untreated, and now this dissatisfaction in life because, you know, that's kind of indirectly related to your manic states and having these goals that you just can't accomplish. And then you also have no remorse, have no guilt, severe lack of empathy. You're also a narcissist. And then also, so let's see, I was interested in his background, right? As a child, see if anything there could contribute to, you know, the person he is, the horrible human being he is. So I did see that he was an only child and he did have a very strict, physically abusive father. Apparently his dad, Karl Madsen, he worked in Nazi Germany. I mean, this just literally seems like the building blocks to, you know, create a monster here were just, they were just all placed, you know? So yeah, dad worked in Nazi Germany and when asked about his father, actually compared living with his father to living with a Nazi Gestapo. And so a lot of this lack of empathy also could have stemmed from this. And that's his parents also finally split up. So, you know, dad is this Nazi Gestapo type and mom apparently was about 30 years younger than him. And she was more submissive and very religious, apparently. And when they split up, Madsen was left to stay with dad. And so his primary caretaker now is this really abusive, physically abusive father. And he may have been struggling with some abandonment issues related to his mom. And this kind of turns into this hatred for women. He did seem to, when, you know, was asked about, you know, what it was like having to stay with dad, there did seem to be some resentment there towards mom. And so this could have turned into this hatred towards women, which was stemming from hatred and abandonment directed towards mom. Now, all of this being said, there are plenty of people with insanely traumatic backgrounds and several people struggle with very many different types of mental health conditions, bipolar disorder, depression, other mood disorders, schizophrenia. None of them are, you know, most of them, like 99% of them, they are not trapping women in submarines in the bottom of the ocean and beheading them and torturing them and cutting up their body parts and then lying. I mean, no, all of this can be said about Madsen. Like, we can sit here and talk about his psychiatric background all day and still none of it excuses anything that he did. This guy was clearly able to, you know, live in society. He understood right from wrong. He was a smart person. He knew societal norms. He knew when he said something appropriate. He knew what he was doing wrong because that's why he lied about what he did. That's why he had to He didn't say, hey, you come into this submarine with me so I can kill you. No, he had to lie. He knew he was doing something bad. He knew he had to cover it up. And none of his background excuses what he did at all. He can have this entire background and still he is expected to not do something like what he did. So, you know, I just think it's interesting, though, to still kind of just explore who this person could have been. And that's about it, because I don't want to explore any more of who he could be, because to me, most of what he is just this monster that did one of the most horrific crimes that I have honestly looked into. Okay, so I don't want to close this episode or get towards the end without giving you guys a brief summary into the ridiculous escape attempt Madsen made in October 2020. All right, so, you know, remember he's put in jail and put in prison in 2018. So he's there for about 2 years now. And apparently he began planning this escape around March 2019. And it was in response to the horrible living condition that inmates serving life sentences are exposed to, you know, so he needed to make a point and he doesn't deserve to be there, of course. So he's escaping, right? So the entire escape lasted a little under 5 minutes. All right. So he didn't get that far. It wasn't like Ted Bundy who escaped and like actually was out there for quite a while and brought himself back. You know, no, this was like 5 minutes. Okay. He created this fake pistol and this fake explosives belt. And the pistol was made out of plaster that he was collecting in the prison over several months. And the explosive belt was made out of brushes, random wires, you know, just little random trinkets that he can find. I mean, this feels like a sitcom episode that I've seen. You know, back in like the 90s when someone is trying to do like a bank robbery and they have like a fake explosives belt on. Okay, so this happened and he went up to this psychologist who was working in the prison and threatened her with this fake pistol and, you know, manages to get past the psychologist because of this. And, you know, he's running out. There's like photos of him in front of the prison walls and then within 5 minutes, they catch the guy and he's just like sitting on the ground and like refusing to get up. And he's brought right back in. So anyways, an extra 21 months is added to his sentence because of this. And he's also moved to a higher security facility because of this. So one article that I was looking at a couple articles that were discussing the escape. And then I found mentioned once again that life sentences last on an average of 16 years in Denmark. May possibly last longer if the criminal is considered a threat. And I mean, I'm just, you know, I'm kind of annoyed and worried. You know, why is this even being brought up? Because regardless of this escape attempt, Madsen needs to be locked up, you know, for life, away for good. I mean, I keep hearing mention of this like 16-year average, and it's like, wait, are we really considering this? Is he going to get 20 years, 25? I don't think that should even be something that's discussed. Okay, so that was my brief summary on Madsen's very brief escape attempt. Honestly, I hope it just made him miss the outside world even more. Okay, so I like to finish up with, you know, a moment where I kind of talk about my murder theory, you know, what happened on the day of. Honestly, I've been saying a lot of what happened is recorded. You know, there's footage. There's, you know, this guy was also closely followed. So we have a lot of documentation on how he was living and what he was going through. A lot of people could speak on his personality. So I don't feel like there's too much conjecture that I'm making here. We got a lot of footage here, but okay. So I mentioned in episode one that I feel like this guy was spiraling for a while in general. He got kicked off the suborbitals team and started Rocket Madsen space team. And, you know, he watched his own documentary and you see he can't stop focusing on them and being kicked off the team. He is, you know, feeling rejected. He's angry. He's pissed off. His own team now is, you know, realizing that he's not getting anything done. So they're dropping off and he's flipping out because, you know, you even catch him on camera a couple of times, just throwing things around. He's calling team meetings and no one's really showing up. Morale is down. And yeah, so he kind of hits rock bottom in a way. And he's this angry, nasty man in general. So rock bottom for him is feeds these like dark, violent thoughts that he has. And so that's going on. And then he also is this dark, violent man with really, really demented fantasies. And, you know, he's kind of acted out some of them in some of these play parties that he's gone to in the BDSM community, but it's not enough. You know, he doesn't want the consent. He wants to really just harm someone, like a lot of these videos that he's watching. And so that's the other thing. He's sitting here watching these videos and it's feeding all these fantasies, and he's angry, and he's spiraling, and he's a narcissist, and he is, you know, has no remorse, no guilt, can't feel empathy. And so, you know, my hypothesis is that he reached out to a couple people and had a few people in mind that he wanted to take into the submarine. All of them always had something else going on. There was one woman that he was very close to actually getting into the submarine, and last minute she had to cancel. And then, unfortunately, Kim Vall reaches out again, and he's like, you know what? Okay, here, perfect victim. So in a way, you know, this was planned. It had been planned for a while. There's even text messages where he's like talking out this fantasy with certain people of what he wants to do. And they were very specific, very, very specific. And it seems like very much like probably what he did. And then in a way, it's a crime of opportunity when it comes to the victim. I don't think he was always planning for it to be Kim Vall, but, you know, Kim Vall just ended up being there when he needed it. And at that moment, you know, almost like wrong place, wrong time. It was at that peak of just everything falling apart for him. And he's like, okay, I'm going to do it. I don't care. And wow, look, this person just texted me once again, wants to actually get on my submarine. Perfect. So I don't think after that anything else was opportunity. I think it was very planned and he stuck with the plan and he just went with it. And you see that in some of the footage where he's packing up the submarine. You know, he's meticulously grabbing what he's going to need. He's clearly already thought of what he's going to need. He's texting Kim Vall for the meeting point and for the time. He goes through each step. They're on the submarine. They're waving at, you know, father and son who are there excited. He knows exactly what he's going to do. And then they descend and then, you know, they go under. And I'm sure this must have just been absolutely terrifying. I don't feel like he probably took too much time in, you know, in showing his true colors. I'm sure within the first half hour, he probably, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if it was right when they got down there. He said something really, really creepy, like, hey, you really shouldn't have done this. I do think he felt like he created the submarine in some ways because of this, you know, he's this engineer and he's really interested in this type of stuff. But I do also think it was like this lair for him where he could be alone and do some of his, you know, have some of his darkest desires come to fruition. And I'm sure he's even maybe alone has done many creepy things in there. And so I feel like he probably was very, very vocal about what he was going to do and what he wanted to do. And he wasn't really hiding anything. It was probably a very terrifying situation to be a part of. And then I think, in my opinion, I feel like because he was so caught up in the plan and fulfilling this fantasy and all the details of getting the victim and what's going to happen and what I'm going to need. I don't think he thought past much further past that. And you can see that in literally the next morning. It's like, you didn't think that we're probably going to ask where the person that was coming to do a article on you, like, you're not going to think we're going to ask where that person is? Like, literally, the boyfriend's waiting. Wire magazine is waiting. There are people that are, you know, this is someone that people are going to be looking for. And it's not like you're in an alleyway or you're at a club or somewhere in the city and you can say that, oh, someone else took her. You literally took her to a place where no one else was but you. So literally no one else could have done something but you. You're trying to say that you dropped her off, but you literally drop her off somewhere where there's a camera. So like, you didn't even think about that. Someone being this like engineer, spacecraft, submarine person, you would think they'd think about that. So in my opinion, this person just literally was so engulfed in the fantasy, and they planned so meticulously when it came to that, where they totally forgot about planning anything else. Maybe also didn't even care. You know, that's why I said early, I wonder, you know, what the life sentence meant to them. You know, maybe they were just done with life and felt like, whatever, life sentence, this is it. I don't care about going to jail. Or it could have been, you know, life sentence is like 16 years. I don't mind too much. That's not the worst thing that's, you know, worth my fulfilling my fantasy. So it could be either or. Could be that they just didn't care, or literally, I think more so that it was that they were just so caught up in their fantasy that they didn't even plan or think much further past that. And I think we can see that where in the fact that they start making up all these lies and all these stories. So clearly, Madsen didn't want to go to prison, would rather have not been in prison, but also just didn't put much thought into what story he's going to come up with. So I think, again, I think that's kind of the murder theory I have. Even though, honestly, there was just so much information here that I didn't really have to come up with too much. This is honestly what we see in footage. This is what the evidence tells us. And yeah, I'm sure this was just a terrifying, horrifying experience. And this is the type of person that never, ever, ever needs to be let out of prison. So there have been quite a few memorials in response to what happened here with Kim Ball, and then fellowships and fundraisers as well. And one that I found here that looked really, really wonderful was hosted by the International Women's Media Foundation. And this is the Kim Ball Fund. It was founded in 2018, so really shortly after, you know, everything happened here. And the fund awards women and non-binary individual with money to pursue their own journalistic careers in a field that's historically been male dominated. Some of that just, you know, being because of the dangers involved in itself. This memorial fund really seeks to push past those boundaries and create safer spaces and more opportunities for female and non-binary journalists. I have a quote here from Kim Ball's parents, Ingrid and Joaquin Ball. They're saying, "We can never get Kim back, but we can see to it that her spirit will live on and inspire other young journalists to go out in the world and find the stories. More than ever, we need brave female journalists who give voices to the people that normally never hit the front pages." This was, you know, a lot of Kim Ball's work focused on disadvantaged populations that really don't get their stories told and really are exposed to a lot of danger and a lot of inequity. And so this fund here is just, you know, trying to bring some of those opportunities to journalists who also don't really get to be in the field as much just because of, you know, there's a lot of danger sometimes going into these environments in the first place. I want to finish off here with a quote that I found by Kim Ball herself. And it was really beautiful and really hopeful and, you know, a little heartbreaking. But at the same time, you know, I feel like Kim Ball left us with a lot of beautiful stories and made such an impact. So in many ways, the quote is really hopeful and inspiring at the same time. So she says, although so much has changed so quickly, one thing has remained constant. There is still no substitute for real reporting. Now is a strange time to become a journalist, but I'm just so excited.